Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Errol Yabake.
And I'm Mike Heslin.
Today, Mike, we talk about democracy.
We do.
In Brazil, in Israel, and right here in the US and A.
But first, in case you need a break from all things democracy related, which we get, we'll share a warning or maybe an invitation to some psychedelic toads.
That you probably shouldn't lick. But if you stick around to the end of this episode, you'll be in for a special oratory surprise from the one and only Mike Heslin.
Let's set expectations high. Let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Hey, Errol.
Michael T. Heslin. How are
it
you,
is
buddy?
So good to see you. So good to be back in the saddle.
It is so good to see you. Virtual cheers.
Yes, for sure. Here, you know what I'll do? Cheers. Old school News and Brews sound effects.
Oh, love that. Love that. I like how you didn't get it too close to the microphone because you're like, it could spray.
could overwhelm people.
What have you been up to? I almost forgot what your, you know, beautiful face with nice skin looked like.
You know, listeners might think that we've been on a break. What they don't know is that this is my break. Working, family stuff.
Family of three.
Well, five if you count the parents.
Yeah, we don't count. You know that.
Six if you count the dog. No, I think, you know, it's been a pretty busy few months, and I was not able to keep up with the news day to day as much as I typically do, let alone put together coherent thoughts on it, but excited to be back and here with you. I think your last few months have actually been a little more to write home about.
Yeah, I got on airplanes again. That's like a thing that we do now. But yeah, I guess we last recorded in August. And since then I've been in Senegal and Morocco and Ghana and Switzerland. And I'm sure I'm forgetting something. But just kind of reorienting myself with airlines and airports and all that good stuff. But it's actually fine, Mike, because like nothing's really happened since August.
Sure.
So like we only cover stuff when it actually is newsworthy, which is why we're here today to talk about, you know, democracy and other things. But
yeah. Last time we spoke, all the vibes were moving in a good direction. And now we've got a positive midterm outcome and basically nothing else happened in between.
Yeah, nothing else matters in between. So We're like only going to record when there's good news, I think. So what are you drinking, Mike?
So I've got this fine day, an Ancho Transcontinental Dry Cider. Listeners might know Ancho Cidery, great cidery here in DC. This is a dry cider, nice and crisp, not too overwhelming on any dimension. Just like if you, it sort of transports you to an apple orchard with the family. Knowing that it'd be nice to have a little buzz going.
What's it called? What's the Ancho called?
Transcontinental.
Transcontinental. Well, I have an Ancho dry cider.
All right.
District dry, which I would associate everything you said there because I don't have a really fine discerning palate. It's lovely and appley and alcoholic. So what more can you want?
Happy fall to us.
Well, what do you say? Let's talk about the news.
Let's do it. So we're talking about many aspects of democracy today, but I get one fun one before we start talking about the important stuff.
Democracy is fun, Mike.
We start this week with a warning from the National Park Service, which put a post on Facebook last week about the Sonoran Desert Toad, also known as the Colorado River Toad. This, Errol, is one of the largest toads that lives in the U.S., and the sound it makes is a weak, low-pitched toot, according to NPS.
This is such good news.
So if you have one around, you can blame it. But the warning wasn't about the toots. The warning was for national park visitors to refrain from licking the toad.
Got it.
That's because, in addition to toots, the Sonoran Desert Toad secretes a quote-unquote toxin, which the doctors, maybe at the National Park Service, claim can be dangerous to your health. But what we know is that the secretion also contains an intense hallucinogen called 5-MeO-DMT, which has been used by the likes of Mike Tyson and Hunter Biden. So as we talk for the rest of this episode about who will control the levers of government, just know that the current government is staying true to form, letting you know you shouldn't lick these toes because it might just be really awesome. So says NPS Director Barbara Streisand.
I can't believe you started us off with this. It's such a good story. Also for the five-year-old listeners, like, you just hit a home run. Toots and frogs, like, you know, my daughter was a frog. I know you said toad, but same. Mm-hmm. Frog for Halloween. Man, I'm actually gonna let them listen to this one.
Beautiful. Maybe just if they ask questions, don't answer.
Don't lick the toad, I feel like it's good advice for my kids.
Yeah, that's fair.
Don't lick the insert thing here is a current challenge with the two-year-old.
Yeah, they actually had the NPS put out a sort of funny post when they made this announcement and said, as we say with most things you come across in a national park, whether it be a banana slug, unfamiliar mushroom, or a large toad with glowing eyes in the dead of night, please refrain from licking.
Oh, that's great. I'm gonna have to show my kids that. So I don't know if there's any toads in Brazil, but I want to take us to Brazil real quick, because we actually lied to you. There was some stuff that went on, you know, between August and now, and one of them was that there was an election in Brazil. And it wasn't just the vote, it was the lead up to the election. And to be honest, Mike and I would text throughout September and October, and I'd be like, holy shit, Brazil, there's some stuff going down. So let me just explain a little bit what happened. Spoiler alert, democracy did actually prevail at the end of this. So lest people like stop listening and start doom scrolling, like, hear me out. So apparently the guy who was just sent to jail for corruption, not just, but like in the past, sent to jail for corruption, was better than the super corrupt guy who wanted to autocratize Brazil. I'm not even sure if autocratize is a word, but I feel like it should be.
We'll make it happen.
Yeah, DMs are open. The two main players in this story are Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, aka Lula, and Jair Bolsonaro, aka right-wing nutjob. Lula on the far left, Bolsonaro on the far right. So I'm going to start with Lula. So he's a former Brazilian president from the late 2000s who couldn't even run again for president in 2018 because he was literally serving a 580-day sentence for accepting a bribe from a Brazilian construction firm.
Now, did that charge get reversed or something? I feel like I've seen that.
I mean, he served 580 days. It may have been reversed. I didn't see that, but this was basically like he was charged and then convicted of giving the construction firm access to Petrobras, the state-owned oil company. So, you know, made a few friends a little bit of money, you know, MBD. So that's Lula. Bolsonaro became a household name for those that were paying attention during the Trump years, because the sort of two merry old white guys felt a bit like two sides of the same right-wing coin. Stop me if you've heard this before, but Bolsonaro also talked for months about the supposed unreliability of the Brazilian voting system in the lead up to the election, which led many people, including a certain podcast co-host, to fear that Lula would perpetuate a Brazilian version of the big lie if he were to lose, essentially because that's what he was saying, right? The problem is that Brazil doesn't really have the broad institutional strength that kept the U.S. moving forward after January 6th, even after a former president refused to accept that he lost. Like, we can have a debate over the strength of those institutions, but I think there's little debate as to U.S. strength of institutions versus Brazilian strength. And so this is not an inconsequential thing. It's like, oh, Trump's an idiot, you know, because he didn't accept the loss, but like, whatever, we move on as a country. Well, Brazil may not have been able to move on as a country. And so the campaign itself was wild. So I'll put a link to a good summary article in the show notes from the BBC. But if you imagine a word cloud, the largest words in the word cloud are all the usual suspects. So deforestation, COVID lockdowns, conservative, you know, far right, far left, corruption, Satanism and devil worship, cannibalism, et cetera.
So cannibalism?
Literally cannibalism. Cool. There was a story about like that Lula's campaign put out about like Bolsonaro went into the Brazilian rainforest in like 2016 or something. There was a New York Times article about this too. And he apparently like there was some tribe that was like cooking a human and he was like made to watch this like human be cooked. So anywho, super normal campaign.
I did some flash research. The charges against or his convictions against Lula were annulled, but it was on a technicality because the Supreme Court said that the court that convicted him lacked the necessary jurisdiction.
Right. So yeah. So, but he still served 580 days in jail. Anyways, fast forward to last week, I believe it was. Ultimately, Lula, this guy who served in jail for something that was annulled because of a technicality, he won. He won and he is now going to be sworn in as the next Brazilian president. This will be his third term. He served two in the 2000s, and now this will be his third. It was closer than expected slash hoped, but he did win. And this is where I think Trump and Bolsonaro diverge, because upon losing to his ex-convict arch rival, Bolsonaro did in fact concede, accepting what election authorities said was a free, open, and fair election.
So I followed this in the immediate days after the election, where Bolsonaro didn't say anything for like 48 hours and then said something that was a little bit pugnacious still. And then like his top advisor came out and said, you know, I've been given authorization from the president to start the transfer of power. Is that still where it is? Or have we heard like an actual concession or
no? Yeah, I'm pretty sure he has actually conceded.
Nice.
Yeah. There were a couple of days where it was a little touch and go. I mean, there were, again, stop me if you've heard this before, but there were truckers that like blocked a highway. Mm-hmm. And people were like very unhappy and, you know, blaming on a voting system and voter fraud and all this other stuff. And essentially Bolsonaro, for whatever reason, has decided that he is going to have to accept the loss. And so here we are.
And the biggest upside of this, I just saw news today that Lula has announced they will be at zero deforestation in Brazil by 2030. So has already, you know, begun rolling back the increase in deforestation under Bolsonaro in the Amazon, and has plans to roll it back entirely.
I hope that's true for the sake of the planet. I hope that's true. I mean, we get so much oxygen from that rainforest, and just to see it be destroyed was really hard. But also they need to figure out some sort of money earning potential for the folks that live over there too. So it's not as easy as like, let's start deforestation. You know, hopefully Lula mm-hmm. has a plan to actually provide some sort of income or facilitate some sort of income for the folks that live in those places. If not, they're just going to illegally deforest, because mm-hmm. that's generally what happens. We in Brazil, democracy prevailed in delivering a peaceful and accepted transition of power. In Israel, democracy re-delivered Bibi Netanyahu. So not sure whether that is prevailing or failing or just doing its messy thing. Somebody famous once said that democracy is the worst kind of government except for all the other ones.
I mean, Israel is such a tough case. I was there for work a few years back, and just talking to people there, they're so disenchanted with the political process. I mean, they're on like 5 elections in 4 years or something at this point. It's likely that, you know, this is a pretty fragile coalition that Bibi will put together if he is in fact able to put it together. And they're likely headed to at least one more in the next year or two. It's such a, we think that the political environment's toxic here. I mean, people in Israel have felt like they were under siege basically since the formation of the country.
Which is why this election is actually really interesting. Mm-hmm. Because as you said, there have been four elections in 2 years, this being, I think, the fifth. And so, you know, listeners would be forgiven if they're like, wait, another Israeli election? Like, didn't we just have like four of those? And the answer is yes, we did. But I think I want to put a little bit of meat on those bones that you put out, because I think it's worth not going through like a full Errol historical rant, but just like a brief recap of the absolute shit show that has been Israeli politics recently. So Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu led Israel as prime minister for 12 years, ending with his ouster in June 2021. And I remember thinking at the time, and honestly, we may have talked about it on this podcast even, that I was both surprised by his loss and hopeful that Israel could move towards a more sort of pluralistic, moderate mm-hmm. form of coalition government. Apparently my glasses that day were particularly rose-colored, because ultimately that day there was a coalition that ousted Bibi again in June 2021. Before that, there had been four elections in 2 years. Elections that Bibi's party had technically won each previous time, but was 0-3 in the ability to form a government. Mm-hmm. So basically it was a cycle. Like, there would be an election, he would sort of win and then be unable to form a coalition government. And then there would be an election and then so on and so forth. The coalition that finally ousted him in June of last year was super unwieldy. There were like eight different parties spanning the far left to the far right,
yep.
From super secular to super religious, which, as you know, matters greatly in Israel, all basically united behind ousting Bibi. And so here we are 18 months later that it turns out they couldn't really govern, you know, succeeded in ousting Bibi, but couldn't actually accomplish anything because, yep. again, unwieldy coalition. And this time, so there was an election that was called, and this time the guy his supporters call King Bibi was ready. And this is, I think, where it gets to your voter apathy point you were making before, because there was something that was different this time. So despite consistent corruption allegations and lots of people, including me, wondering whether, like Lula in Brazil in 2018, whether Bibi would actually be able to run from office, from jail, for example, he focused on one thing and one thing only this time around: turnout. It's, you know, as you said, it's natural to assume that after so much turmoil, like, people are just like throwing up their hands and being like, I just don't care, which is exactly, I think, what the narrative was leading into this. I think what pundits and other watchers didn't realize was that this November surprise turnout, like, there was huge turnout. That's the spoiler alert. And that was not a surprise. That was a surprise to everybody except for Likud, Bibi's party. So Israeli elections, as I understand them, are usually about persuading undecided voters to choose one of a zillion different parties. And a lot of it is sort of the cult of the party leader, and just kind of like making a case over like far left green, far left religious, like whatever it is, they're, you know, deciding. They're sort of appealing to undecided voters, not this time. So realizing that voters mistrusted social media, which had been the prime sort of method through which parties would try to do that persuasion, realizing that voters mistrusted social media, which, as an aside, wouldn't that be nice? Likud focused on voter contact. Door to door, you know, door knocking, WhatsApp and Telegram groups, you know, text messages, phone calls, and it worked. 71.3% of eligible voters cast ballots, which, wow. as an aside, wouldn't that be nice? And Bibi, Likud, and their likely allies in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, will have 64 seats, enough for a governing majority. It could be shaky, as you mentioned, but there's a likely coalition. Yep. Which means for the first time in five elections, Bibi is expected to be able to form a government. So
all right.
Here we are, back to the hard right Zionism of the past decade and a half. And he's
gone harder right, even, right? There are some like really far right parties that he was sort of wary of historically that he now has brought into his coalition.
Yeah. And I think the question is, has he gone to the further right? Have they gone sort of more to his only far rightness as opposed to extreme far rightness? Who knows? I think in any case, he's going to continue to be antagonistic and towards Iran, towards the Palestinians. Listeners will remember he had a really antagonistic relationship with Barack Obama. In 2015, he came to the United States, did not even meet with Barack Obama, and spoke to the U.S. Congress, which is like a huge no-no.
Yeah, well, we'll keep watching this space.
Definitely. Well, let's get on to our main story, which continues in this theme of democracy, except bringing it home.
Tuesday marked the end of the 2022 midterm elections, and in these midterms, American democracy got a strong pass. Democrats across the country soundly beat expectations, which started low for the party in power amid historically high inflation, concerns about a recession, simmering culture wars, and the historical precedent of the president's party getting absolutely rocked in midterm elections by low information voters like Elon Musk.
Who did Elon vote for?
So I call that out because Elon, who we'll have to catch up on in our next episode, because he has been a busy guy.
He's been busy. Fixing Twitter like you hoped he would.
We'll come back to it. But specifically, he said right before the election that, you know, Democrats have the presidency, so people should vote for Republicans for the House and Senate. This is a dumb thing to say for many reasons, not least because it is transparently motivated reasoning, right? Elon is mad at liberals, so he wants people to vote Republican. You didn't see him tell people in Virginia to vote blue for the state legislature since they elected Glenn Youngkin governor last year.
Yeah.
But this trend in general, right, voting for whoever is not in power, is called thermostatic voting. And it means that whenever one party has power, voters tend to turn the dial back the other way and vote for the other party.
Yeah.
This precedent is so common that every single change in control of the House since 1955 has happened in a midterm election.
Wow.
So for this reason, predictions.
Every single one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Predictions going into last Tuesday generally ranged from red wave to red tsunami, both of which you heard a lot of. 538's forecast gave Republicans an 84% chance of taking the House, with the median forecast giving them about a 20-seat majority. It also gave Republicans a 59% chance of winning the Senate, with an expectation of 51 or 52 seats. Some forecasts had a little bit tighter, but the vibes going into Tuesday were not great.
Yeah.
Instead, Democrats kept control of the Senate. Over the weekend, as mail ballots were counted, it became clear that both Mark Kelly in Arizona and Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada won re-election, giving the Democrats 50 seats so far, and they will have 51 after Raphael Warnock absolutely wipes the floor with Herschel Walker, the Georgia runoff next month.
You better be knocking some wood.
Always, always. So far, the only Senate seat that has switched parties is the Pennsylvania seat won by John Fetterman. And I'll just say quickly of the Pennsylvania race, it speaks well of the Democratic Party and the Fetterman campaign and the Pennsylvania electorate in general that they successfully painted Dr. Oz as an outsider because he lived in New Jersey and owned 10 houses and talked about crudité, and not because he's a Muslim guy named Mehmet who served in the Turkish army.
Nothing against Turks.
Of course.
No, I think his name is like Özçakır or something, which when he first got on TV, they were like, dude, you can't be called Özçakır. Like you have to, you have to change it to Oz. But yes, that is funny that like the outsider was not the fact, like he had even said that he wasn't going to renounce his Turkish citizenship or something. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to be receiving all of these like super highly classified briefings as a member of the Senate. And he was like, nah, I'm good.
Yep.
But no, the outsiderness was Jersey.
Yeah. So Dems keep the Senate. The House is still too close to call a week later. As of this morning, Republicans are favored to win and they're favored to take 221 House seats, which is just over the 218 they need for a majority. So far, 217 of those have been called for Republicans. So likely in the next day or two, we will hear that they have actually taken the House.
And we're recording on Tuesday, by the way.
Yeah. But their margin will be very slim. On the state level, Dems also performed extremely well, which is not something we're used to saying. They won almost every close governor election in swing states, including Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan. There were two governorships that flipped from red to blue, which includes Wes Moore in Maryland, who was kind of overlooked since it's such a blue state and he had a weak MAGA opponent. But he's a real star and will be excellent for Maryland. I'm very excited about him.
Yeah, Wes, well, you're a Maryland guy, so I take your word for it. But yeah, he seems really impressive. Fun fact, he ran in the primary against Tom Perez, had a huge role in the Democratic Party before. So, you know, we're going to talk about candidate quality in a little bit, and we'll just come back to that because these two gentlemen were really high quality.
Yeah, candidates. Yeah. Tom Perez was Secretary of Labor under Obama and then DNC chair. And so all of the election deniers running for Secretary of State races had me very worried going into it.
Same.
And exactly one of them won the race. And that was in Indiana, which Trump won by 17 points anyway.
Yeah, the six states where this mattered the most, they all lost.
Yep, yep. State legislatures also shifted toward the Dems, which doesn't even happen in blue wave elections typically. Going into this election, there are 99 state legislative chambers across the country, right? Two in almost every state except Nebraska, which is unicameral.
Fun fact, I did not know that.
Oh, yeah.
Man, you just civics lesson. Love that.
Of those, Republicans controlled 62 going into the election. Democrats controlled 36. And the Alaska House was controlled by a bipartisan coalition. So as of now, Democrats have flipped three of those chambers and there are a few still uncalled. So they have increased it to at least 39. Michigan and Minnesota flipped to full Democratic control between the governor and both houses of the state legislatures, wow, which hasn't happened in generations. And ballot initiatives then followed the same trend. So there were five abortion initiatives on the ballot in Vermont, Michigan, and California to enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution, and then in Kentucky and Montana to ban abortion.
Yeah.
All five of those resulted in favor of abortion rights. That's on top of Kansas doing the same earlier this year.
Yep.
Other initiatives legalized marijuana in Maryland and Missouri, although similar measures did fail in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Arkansas. And, you know, there were some tough spots too, which we can talk about. Ron DeSantis cruised to re-election in Florida after just barely eking out a victory in 2018. New York saw Republicans take a bunch of House seats, which I'm guessing two different friends of the show, David Imamura and John Bisignano, would have a lot to say since it was very closely tied into the redistricting drama in that state.
What's interesting about that quickly is that, like, I remember that Imamura show and it was really excellent. The narrative that I've seen on all sides of the political spectrum is that that was a Democratic gerrymandered map that Imamura put together, which, again, I'm no scholar of this, but, like, it was striking to me that that was the prevailing narrative when he was, I mean, obviously he's one person coming on and talking about what he did. He's a friend of yours, et cetera. But it seemed like what they were doing was trying very hard to get Republicans, you know, to come along and help draw the maps, and they weren't getting anything. And so they did their best. And because they had no Republicans involved, it was seen as, you know, super hyper partisan and got rejected.
If you listen to that episode and what David said, you know, the intention was for that commission that he chaired to be bipartisan and to be separate from the legislative political back and forth. But if you listen to his interview, there were some rifts that appeared pretty quickly between the Democratic and Republican appointed members of that commission. And I think the outcome was that the map they produced was seen as Democratic.
Right.
All in all, the top line is that if this was a red wave, it was like one guy in a MAGA hat in Yankee Stadium getting up out of his seat and trying to get everyone else to get up with him. But all he got was a beer thrown in his face like he's Ted Cruz.
True story.
Errol, what are your big takeaways based on the results we've seen so far?
So I think this is where I'm going to pretend to be a pundit, because I think, like a lot of people and probably listeners of, if you're listening to a podcast called News and Brews, you probably watched or at least, you know, listened or read about the midterms. And so this is my kind of distillation of the various themes that I gathered. Obviously, it was a good night for Democrats. The only thing that I would add to your, I think, excellent summary was that 75% of the Cook Political Report toss-up races went to Democrats. So again, not only was it not a red wave, maybe it was like a red trickle, but like the competitive ones, the toss-up ones, three-fourths of them went to Democrats. Wow. I think that having been said, you know, and I think this is with the exception of, you know, like New York and Florida and parts of California, like you said, this has been seen as a good night for Democrats, which I think is true. But I also think that there's a lot that Democrats can learn out of this. And one can only hope that they don't rest on their laurels too much. And like take the victory lap, et cetera, but then like actually figure out what happened. And I think what happened was that where democracy and protecting the right to an abortion were on the ballot, this is those Secretary of State races with election deniers. This is, you know, all the abortion, you know, states where abortion was under threat. Democrats exceeded expectations, Pennsylvania, Arizona, et cetera.
Yeah.
Where they weren't, that's where you saw that red wave, New York, California, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we're still waiting for a lot of the California races to come in, but it does seem clear that New York and Florida were outliers in this trend. I don't know if they're, will prove to be a single explanatory variable or not. But just what you've heard so far, you know, in Florida, a lot of the coverage has highlighted a gap in organizing and fundraising capabilities between the state Republican and Democratic parties. And it sounds like there is a lot of ground to make up, right, for the Florida Democratic Party over the next few cycles. And it's going to take time and a lot of grassroots organizing. In New York, many have pointed to the media narrative, particularly around crime. This is something that Republicans tried to push nationally. Jon Stewart had a great segment kind of tracing, you know, from a couple months back, Fox News running polls that showed that Democrats were most mistrusted on crime out of all the issues. And then subsequently over the next couple months preceding the election, headlining every single show with massive crime wave you know, is the scourge of American cities. And I think there was some reality there, particularly in New York, huge media market. And if you look at some of the New Jersey data, where districts, they have districts in the New York media market and districts in the Philly media market, and even some legislative districts that are split between the two, and areas that were in the New York market performed much more Republican leaning than those in the Philly market.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that sort of proves my point in a way, where let's imagine in an alternate universe that abortion was under threat in New York and that there were election deniers up and down the ballot in New York. There were some in New York, but I think it wasn't like a prevailing thing. People weren't worried about the state of democracy as the primary thing. If that were the case, I think crime may have come third. Right. And I think people would have been, you know, Democrats seem to have been really animated by those two things. And in the absence of those two things around which to be animated, you had crime dominating. So I think that's a really interesting point. The second, so I think there's the first main takeaway is that like it was a good night for Democrats, asterisk, right? And we need to learn that asterisk is points to a footnote that says Democrats need to actually take a hard look at what happened.
Yeah. Democrats can't have good news without an asterisk.
We can't, we're just incapable. The second thing is that the big lie was a losing platform, right? And you had covered a little bit of this in your intro, and we'll post, the Washington Post had a really excellent sort of recap of those six most important battleground states where in each one of them, the people who would have been responsible for elections that were election deniers, they all lost.
Yep. Yep. And one thing you heard a lot about, particularly on election night, as governor and legislative returns started to come in and actually diverge from one another in a lot of states, was this phenomenon of ticket splitters. So I'm guessing we'll see a lot of ink spilled, a lot of donuts purchased for focus groups around ticket splitters in the next coming months.
It was fascinating.
They basically almost all split toward a rebuke of Trump and MAGA.
Yeah. So
in New Hampshire, Kris Sununu won re-election as governor, but Maggie Hassan, the Democratic senator, won handily over Don Bolduc, who went full election denier.
Yeah.
In Georgia, Brian Kemp.
He went full election denier, but then backtracked, but then went full election denier, then backtracked. And if it's one thing Granite State voters love, it's a flip-flopper.
His story is, I've got another point on him later on. His story is quite interesting. But in Georgia, right, Brian Kemp, who didn't speak out against Trump, but certainly had Trump speak out against him and try to take him out in the primary, won much more easily against Stacey Abrams this year than he did in 2018,
yeah.
Which is a massive bummer. But at the same time, Herschel Walker, who wouldn't be there without Trump and was full on MAGA, is losing and headed to a runoff.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, if to put a fine point on this, if the theory about like Republicans vote for Republicans is true in all cases, like you go into a voting booth and you're Republican and you just vote, you know, Republican all the way down, then Walker should have been carried by Kemp.
Right.
But I think what we're seeing is voters splitting. They're really sort of deciding. And this happened in Wisconsin too, not just between Republican candidates, but you know, Ron Johnson, the very conservative Republican senator, was reelected, whereas there was a Democratic governor. And so you have to imagine there were people that voted for Ron Johnson and for the Democratic candidate for governor.
Yeah. And I think there's part of that where just having an existing brand reputation, name recognition, whatever it may be, always carries some uplift too.
Sure.
But we saw the same thing in Pennsylvania, right? Even though both Fetterman for Senate and Josh Shapiro for governor beat Republicans who are aligned with Trump, you had a case there where Doug Mastriano, the GOP candidate for governor, was maybe the most MAGA candidate in the whole country, like literally organized a busload of people to travel down to the Capitol on January 6th.
Wild.
And he lost by much more, right? His race was called much earlier than Dr. Oz's.
Yeah. I think this gets to another point, which I'll get to in a little bit, about candidate quality. But I think it also points to, you know, it begs the question, is there actually a middle, right? I think the prevailing narrative in the lead up to this, especially after 4 years of President Trump and kind of the rancor that has followed President Biden in the first 2 years in partisanship and cultural ways, like we assume that there's not a middle. And so is there actually a middle? Well, maybe, perhaps. Mm-hmm. I don't think this was some sort of, and this is where I put on my pundit hat that I don't actually have. I don't think this was some magical rise of a heretofore unseen political middle. I think people are just really exhausted from all the chaos. Like canceling Dr. Seuss and doing the mental gymnastics needed to continue the big lie just isn't worth the emotional energy of people. And so they were like, you know, I don't love the Democrats, but also this person is batshit crazy and I'm just not going to vote for them.
And we've talked about Republican extremism and overreach on this show. And I think what happened here in part is that this idea of thermostatic voting goes both ways. When you are a party in power with all three, you know, both houses of the legislature and the presidency, it's very hard to get any thermostatic momentum in your own direction. But because of the Dobbs decision, you had a clear and present threat to millions of Americans coming from, as a legacy of Republican policymaking and movement building over years, with you know, the reversal of Roe, the threat to abortion rights. And so there was this concrete movement in policy just a few months before the election on behalf of Republicans that made all of those points about extremism, all of the overreach you saw, all of the chaos, just made it real and effect had a real effect on people's lives. And so you were able to make those arguments, I think, more successfully for the Democrats than you could have absent Dobbs.
Yeah, I think that's right. And who knows what will happen with Dobbs? Like, is Dobbs going to be a motivating factor into the 2024 presidential election? Maybe, if Congress hasn't done anything about it. I think it's probably still going to be a motivating factor.
If there are a bunch more ballot initiatives in 24.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, one of the takeaways that Democrats could take from this is that this was actually a winning thing. Even in places like Kansas that are traditionally seen as pretty conservative, you know, a woman's right to choose what to do with her body seems to be a fairly popular winning message. So my next takeaway is a little bit of a grab bag of just kind of wild ones. And I think this is when the whole narrative is, this is going to be a red tsunami, and then the red tsunami doesn't happen. There's got to be some wild takeaways here.
Yeah.
And my first one is that Lauren Boebert, who is the card carrying, you know, this is a person who owned a bar where, you know, waitresses carried firearms in Colorado. And she's been a, you know, the biggest MAGA head out there. She was listed by pretty much everybody as having like 100% minus maybe 2 or 3% chance of winning her race. Mm-hmm. 538 had her at 97%. And as of recording on Tuesday, you should Google this while we're talking, but as of time of recording, that race hasn't been called yet. She's ahead by like 1,000 votes or something. She may win, but holy crap, this was somebody who was like the poster child of MAGAism, and she may have lost. Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene, MTG, didn't. She cruised to re-election. But if Lauren Boebert loses, that's going to be big. It wasn't always good news. I'll get to something in Washington that happened that was interesting. But, you know, some of my other takeaways of wild things that happened is like, there was this viral moment in the Texas gubernatorial campaign. You know, Beto lost ultimately to Greg Abbott, but in the wake of the Uvalde mass school shooting, really horrific incident, Greg Abbott was hosting a press conference or something, and Beto breaks in and starts essentially asking serious questions and disrupting and just being like incensed in a way that it would have been really nice for Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, to be incensed and to do something about it. And the community of Uvalde seemed to be really kind of like anti-Abbott there for a little bit. And it's worth pointing out that 60% of Uvalde voted for Greg Abbott.
That's wild. That is wild.
Which is wild. Another wild thing for me is that, you know, I'm old enough to remember when Ohio was the tip of the spear. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to have my Democratic friends try to convince me that Ohio and Florida are winnable. And maybe it's, you know, we're getting out invested in places like Florida, you know, on organizing and whatnot, but we just got really, we had good candidates in Florida and Ohio and just got trounced, you know, RIP Ohio and Florida until someone convinced me otherwise. But I wanted to end on a more positive note, this particular soliloquy. So this is Washington State, Washington's third district. Republican Joe Kent lost to a heretofore unknown auto shop owner, Democrat Marie Glusenkamp Perez, in a Washington State district that hasn't been represented by a Democrat in over a decade. 538 said that the Democrat would lose in 98 out of 100 scenarios. There was a 98% chance that Marie was going to lose. Technically, they weren't wrong because they did have two scenarios in which she could win. Mm-hmm. But if you're Joe Kent, you had to feel pretty good going into Tuesday. It's not like one of those races that's yet to be called. He lost. She won. She's coming to Washington. Which is absolutely wild. Now, he, again, getting to candidate quality, he's a former military person and had some kind of questionable views as to, you know, guns and other sort of the role of armed citizens in the United States democracy. Let me just try to put that very diplomatically. But nevertheless, this should have been an easy one for Republicans, particularly in a wave election, and it wasn't. The next takeaway point that I have is that this is a mixed bag. Democrats have trouble celebrating without asterisks and caveats, and so on the one hand, Democrats did something this cycle that was really, really just political, just like capital P political. And this was, people may have read about this. They supported really like wacko candidates in the Republican primaries. They basically like put out attack ads versus more moderate Republican candidates in an effort to bolster like far right Trump supported candidates. And this is like Democratic dollars going to do this, like PAC dollars. And so what the result of that was is that it, not only because of this, but in part because of this, some really bad candidates in the Republican Party were elevated to be. And so this is where Doug Mastriano, Mehmet Oz, you know, there's from across the country, there's examples of where Democrats essentially bolstered these really bad candidates. And in pretty much every instance, it worked. The Democrats yeah. won. So I'm proud of Democrats for once, not just being the ideological, like we're going to do the right thing, which I love. And I, you know, it's one of the things that draws me to the party, but I'm also a bit terrified that worked. You know, that's really high stakes poker.
Well, it is high stakes, but it was a high stakes election, right? That had nothing to do with Democratic strategy. And ultimately we've talked about the headwinds that we're facing Democrats going into this. A situation like that's no time for a prevent defense. I think we even talked about this over the summer. I was very heartened to see the Democrats discover strategy in this cycle, not just in that effort to, you know, in Republican primaries, basically put out ads calling out that the super Trumpy candidates were super Trumpy, knowing that that would appeal to Republican primary voters. Yeah, I would group the January 6th hearings in with this as well.
Yeah, you
know, it seems like forever ago that those were making headlines. Yeah, that was really early summer before we had things like the Inflation Reduction Act or the student loan executive order or, you know, the descheduling of cannabis or you know, any of these other big wins that the Democrats had in governing that I think really then kind of took over. But what it did is, you know, if you look at those two strategic moves together, right, elevating the super MAGA candidates while also elevating the insurrection and January 6th and the violence and destruction that was caused that day to back to the top of people's minds, you see that there was a really successful effort there to show very viscerally the threat that this group of people represents, that coupled with their alignment with, you know, the Republican base.
I think that's right. I mean, to take your sports ball reference one step further, like the best defense is a good offense. And I do think that Democrats did play offense here. My slight worry is that the offense that they played with elevating these candidates could backfire in the future. But this is, again, me just being this Democrat that can never like fully enjoy a good night.
Well, yeah, let's talk about the future. I think that might be.
Let's talk about the future. I'm gonna, you know, drink my apple cider here and maybe get some popcorn in the coming weeks, because the Republican reckoning might finally begin? ? Mm-hmm. The question for me is how much the party itself is still scared of Trump voters. So you've started mm-hmm. seeing party officials say negative, outright negative, or at least sort of backhandedly negative things about the former president. But my guess is that nothing about Tuesday changed hardcore views by Trump supporters about Donald Trump.
We won't know until the New York Times goes and asks them in diners.
That's true. We should monitor the op-ed pages for the next interview with a taxi driver. Trump is seeing as having lost. Like, this is the narrative, right? Trump lost, and everyone seems to be calling for the party to move on. Like, obviously, non-Republicans, but even sort of the Republican intelligentsia seems to be, you know, calling for the party to move on, which is precisely, I think, why Trump will be announcing his candidacy for president very soon. And in fact, it could even happen by the time you're listening to this. Like, This is the like quintessential Trump move, is like when you're down, just double down.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a little surprising, though. Maybe it shouldn't be, that we're already starting to see the rats abandon the sinking Trump train. Josh Hawley said publicly that the Republican Party, as we know it, is dead. Don Bolduc, the losing candidate in New Hampshire that we mentioned, got seemingly surprised by a request for a very well-researched interview with Isaac Chotiner from The New Yorker. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but basically, Isaac Chotiner had done a profile on Don Bolduc when he was a candidate and then just called him up after the election. And Don Bolduc was like, "Who is this? Oh yeah, sure, I'll talk to you." But then the questions were like extremely well-researched and laden with receipts.
Oh no.
But basically in this interview, which we can link in the show notes, but Don Bolduc essentially disavowed his previous election denial and tried to say that he hadn't done that when he very famously and publicly had.
Did that.
And as we record now, and as you mentioned, Trump is getting ready to host a primetime announcement tonight, Tuesday night, where he's expected to announce his candidacy for president in 2024. But very few lawmakers are actually going. He's doing it at Mar-a-Lago. There was a story today that Matt Gaetz was planning to go down there, and then, you know, it's raining in DC and he decided not to because he was worried about the flight. So even Matt Gaetz won't be there.
But Trump doesn't care. Trump announced his first presidency on a golden escalator.
Yeah,
with a room,
a room full of paid actors.
With a room full of paid actors. He doesn't care. And in fact, this will just animate him further.
So that being said, the Josh Hawley thing is most interesting to me because you always hear that even if Trump goes away, Trumpism is a more complicated monster. But this election was really a defeat for Trumpism. Trump himself wasn't on the ballot. And so even with a midterm electorate, the Republicans don't have a winning coalition without anti-Trump moderates.
No, they don't.
And the problem is that doesn't change the fact that they also don't have a path to a winning coalition without the MAGA base. So yep. I don't know how they square that, but ultimately that is sort of the play Ron DeSantis has been making most successfully for the last 2 years.
Yeah. And he's getting a lot of love on the right.
Yeah.
Which suits Ron DeSantis just fine. Much of that love is actually like from a kind of decaffeinated political analysis perspective is well-deserved. It's not just his like culture wars. Like anti-wokeness.
Get one cider into you and you're throwing love on Ron DeSantis.
No, I'm just trying to be decaffeinated and even fair and balanced. No, did you watch his like his victory speech?
I didn't see it.
It was all, I just watched a clip and it was all about wokeness. Hmm. And it was like, we showed the woke, you know, youths or something. It was like, he's very much fighting the culture war. Yeah. So Ron DeSantis's victory speech was all about wokeness. And it was, you could see that he was fighting this culture war, but it wasn't just about that. It was the shrewd, dare I say, diabolical utilization of gerrymandering to ensure that there would be at least a 3-vote gain for Republicans in the House. And if you remember, it was a slim Democratic majority. They only needed 5.
Yeah.
And so like they went into, this is why there was thought of a wave or a tsunami. I mean, Republicans were getting 3 automatically just out of the gates in Florida. So it's even wilder that it's, you know, hasn't been called yet and that it's going to get a small majority.
Yeah. Yeah. And before we get ahead of ourselves to what the post-Trump Republican Party is, Trump will almost certainly announce for president tonight, and he should absolutely be considered the front runner to win the GOP nomination.
Yes.
Right. The same electorate that declined to put his most obsequious minions in power also includes the Republican primary voters who chose them in the first place.
Right.
I was looking today at an August Quinnipiac poll in which 72% of Republicans wanted Trump to run in 2024. And when Democrats were asked the same question about Joe Biden, the answer was 47% yes.
Critical point. It's not the Republican Party that decides who the candidate is going to be. It's Republican primary voters.
Yeah.
Who are the same voters that put Mehmet Oz and Don Bolduc and other people in there. So also looking forward, dude, the House is going to be a mess.
Yeah.
Like the Republicans are going to take the majority by in all likelihood, unless something very strange happens, but it's going to be by like a really razor sharp. You talked about a 3-vote majority. I think Republicans like MTG and her merry band of MAGAs will have outsized influence on the entire party. This is, you know, harping back to that Israel Knesset coalition thing. You essentially have a coalition within the Republican Party. And when there is a fractured coalition that is trying to be a majority, the smallest, most sort of vocal, they can withhold support for stuff. And so you have to bring them along. And so they're going to have outsized influence, not just on the agenda, but specifically on future Speaker Kevin McCarthy. And I use that term very deliberately because I do think that he will become Speaker. I think he's a shrewd politician, but they're already giving him shit. And he and he just announced that he's running for Speaker. He'll do just about anything to get there. And once he's there, if he wants to get anything passed, he'll have to bring along the far right.
Yeah, it came out today that Marjorie Taylor Greene got Steve Scalise, who's running to be number two in the party, so majority leader behind a Speaker McCarthy, to agree to investigate Nancy Pelosi and others for the treatment of jailed insurrectionists after January 6th. So, you know, enjoy the lame duck session, because it doesn't look like much serious legislating will be happening after that.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, Hunter Biden's laptop and all this is just it's just going to be wild. So related to that,
like, side note on Hunter Biden's laptop, his press conference the day after the election that Joe Biden gave, a reporter asked him, you know, what do you think about Republicans going after your son with investigations? And his response was, "Lots of luck in your senior year, as my coach used to say." Just the most at ease Joe Biden response I could possibly imagine.
Yeah. He seems not to be super plussed by stuff, which maybe has made him kind of the perfect president for the time. Who knows? We're not going to talk today. We may talk in the future about him running for re-election, but that's certainly what is on lots of people's minds as well. But it's worth pointing out, Mike, that like since the House will most likely flip, the age of sweeping transformative legislative accomplishments that have kind of defined the last 2 years, like the first half of the first term of Joe Biden, that's going to come to an end. And, you know, that having been said, there's a lot that the Senate can do without the House, namely confirming judges.
Yeah.
And I read something somewhere that Dems have already confirmed as many judges as the Trump McConnell coalition did in all 4 years.
Yeah.
And so that's a pretty remarkable accomplishment if you think about it. Life will be easier. We talked about the runoff in Georgia. Life will certainly be easier if Mike's prediction holds and Raphael Warnock beats Herschel Walker in the runoff in December. Because even a 1-vote majority diminishes the individual power of a Sinema or a Manchin.
Yeah. And there is an actual structural difference between 50 and 51 as well. So at 50 senators, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell entered a power sharing agreement that put equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans on every committee. Right. So if there is a party line vote on anything, it's harder to then bring that to the floor for a full Senate vote. It doesn't have committee approval. It just takes longer to get anything done. 51 allows Democrats to pass bills out of committee without Republican support.
Yeah. And I'm sure Kamala Harris is like, please make it 51 so I don't have to keep breaking all these damn ties. Yeah.
The other thing I'll say to this point is, as you know, Joe Biden's administration is full of smart operators, including the president himself, who have been around the block and understand how the Congress works. They had to have been expecting that they would have, you know, probably less power than they will in the Senate and even the House coming out of this midterm election. So if you are, you know, Biden and his chief of staff and senior advisors sitting around in January of 2021, planning out your administration, you are fully planning to front load your legislative work.
Right.
and maybe hold on to some of the more controversial executive actions, other things that he can do without the legislature for the second half of the term when you expect to not have that power or need that leverage in the legislature.
Yeah. And you got to think that, I mean, they've been really savvy so far. And so you've got to think that they're thinking about just that. And if not, hopefully they're listening to News and Brews and, you know, getting advice from two people who have no idea what the hell they're talking about.
You're welcome.
You're welcome. My last point is a pot shot at actual pundits and all their pollster friends. The whole, like, you know, in the last week, I'm sure you've read a lot of this. They're like, just kidding. We all knew it wasn't going to be a red wave, that coverage. And so I just wanted to shout out friend of the pod, John Bisignano, who you name checked earlier, who to his credit has been trying to counter the Red Scare for weeks. But he tweeted Monday night. He said, get excited for the Monday after Election Day. Historically beginning the phase where one, pollsters that were wrong begin to explain that actually they were right. And two, reporters rationalize their absurd claims, noting that all the polls were wrong, but they saw what they wanted to see. Mm.
Yeah, I'll call out a couple other people who deserve credit. Simon Rosenberg, who I was really not familiar with until the run-up to the election when I started following him on Twitter and what he was saying, who was basically calling out the game of the Republican Party, which, let's be honest, has always been a step or two ahead of the Democrats on the whole strategy thing. What they were doing in the last several weeks before the election was flooding the zone with garbage partisan polls to basically skew the averages and then the narrative toward a red wave, which absolutely worked. But ultimately, you know, he was absolutely on the money with what was going on and with what the outcome would be based on just the full range of data he was looking at, including the early vote and nonpartisan polls and how everything was trending.
Yeah.
I'll also note that The Economist predicted a red ripple just before the election, as opposed to a red wave. They even still expected more Republican gains than we're seeing, but I think directionally they went a little bit against the grain and were right in that regard.
Yeah. That makes sense. So that's all my takeaways.
The last thing I'll say on the midterms is that this was a win for Democrats with both big and small Ds. Going into last Tuesday, this all felt very heavy. We always feel like every election is the most important of our lifetimes. But one of the things that we've tried to do on this show is narrate the slippage of American democracy into minoritarian, authoritarian rule. And that's why we talk about the January 6th hearings. It's why we talk about redistricting and so many other things. And if we had seen a red wave in this election, it would have meant a steepening of that slippery slope toward the end of functioning democracy.
Amen.
Not least because on top of the structural damage it would have meant to the future of free and fair elections, it would have also meant that a whole generation and new coalition that came together in 2020 to get rid of Trump would have seen a bunch of obsequious Trump minions take power just 2 years later. Right? Instead, the center held. On top of that, you had all these open election deniers lose on Tuesday and concede quickly, and in some cases, even graciously on top of that. That to me is the most encouraging thing about this election. That slippery slope got a little bit flatter, or as Simon Rosenberg puts it, the red wave might still be coming, but it isn't here yet.
Yeah, I think that's really excellent analysis. Hear, hear. Cheers to that.
All right, should we get into some spicy nuggets?
Let's do it.
How I've missed them. I actually have a democracy related spicy nugget.
Good for you.
And this is a poem from Kyle Tran Meyer called Voting as Fire Extinguisher. It's not that long, so I'm going to read it. When the haunted house catches fire, a moment of indecision. The house was, after all, built on bones and blood and bad intentions. Everyone who enters the house feels that overwhelming dread, the evil that perhaps only fire can purge. It's tempting to just let it burn. And then I remember there are children inside.
I feel like this was just a moment on News and Brews. I feel like you should read poetry more often.
That someone I saw tweet that out, that poem.
It's really good.
Just like sort of that last line like really hits like a ton of bricks.
Yeah, that's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what else is real? Is we now have 8 billion people that live on planet Earth.
Yes.
As of literally today, Tuesday. Listeners will remember that while Mike was on paternity leave, I had Jen Shuba on, Professor Jen Shuba.
Excellent episode.
Yeah, it was a really excellent episode. She is hilarious, but also one of the world's leading demographers thinking about this. Literally wrote a book called 8 Billion and Counting. So my spicy nugget is a little bit self-serving. It is the tweet where we actually tweet out that episode and talk about that really excellent analysis and humor that Jen brought to not only the show, but to this whole idea of 8 billion people on the planet. And if you are not following her on the socials, you should stop whatever you're doing right now and follow her.
Excellent. Well, this has been a pleasure. Great to be back at it with you, Errol.
Yeah. Good to see you again, Mike. We'll hopefully record in, you know, another couple of weeks. We're going to try to do it a little bit more consistently, but probably not every week.
Not every week, but a couple times a month, every 2 weeks, give or take.
It's our damn show. We'll do whatever we want.
And we love doing it. So thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks, Mike.
News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode is recorded Tuesday, November 15th, 2022 at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available every 2 weeks-ish on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.